Well, if you are a regular here, you would know that we're working on a series through the book of Genesis at the moment. If you're visiting or if you haven't been around for a little while, we're working our way through the book of Genesis. We actually began it last year and we've been picking it up again. And so the story so far in the book of Genesis, you can see up there on the slide. We've talked in the past about the creation that takes place in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and then the fall in chapter 3. In chapter 4, we have the story of Cain and Abel, and then we have Adam's family line all the way down to Noah. And then in chapters 6 through to 8, we have wickedness and judgment, the great story about the flood. And last week, George took us through chapter 9, God's covenant with Noah. And today we come to chapters 10 and 11, which I've entitled Records and Rebellion. And the two big things that come up in this chapter are some genealogies, the descendants of Noah's sons, and the Tower of Babel. Now, the passage that we have today is one that actually makes many preachers quake in their boots when they find out they have to deal with these genealogies and the records of numerous births and where all of these children and their descendants travelled. The immediate questions are, what did I do wrong to get landed with this passage? And what on earth am I going to speak about? It basically seems to be a genealogy plus an atlas plus a history book. What relevance and value will this have for the people in my congregation? It's going to take me half the sermon just to read out and pronounce all the names, and people will have tuned out before I even get to the end of the genealogies. What makes it worse is that one of these genealogies even gets repeated and expanded in the second of the two chapters that we're looking at this morning. So the temptation is very strong to just skip over the genealogies and just talk about the Tower of Babel, because at least that's more interesting and something could be drawn out of that. Now, I have to confess that I'm not immune from these kind of thoughts, and they've certainly crossed my mind, obviously, because I just told you about them. But I've resisted the temptation to take the easy path and to skip all over these names. Besides, what would we say to Ashkenaz or Arphaxad or Peleg when we get to heaven and they ask us if we read their names in the genealogy? I think there are some things for us to learn from the whole of the passage set for today's message. So let me begin by reading the genealogies that are in chapter 10 and also partly in chapter 11. And I'm going to put them up on the screen here, and I'm reading from the New Living Translation. This is, please follow along if you can, or just watch the screen and listen and see if you can see your name up there. This is the account of the families of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah. Many children were born to them after the great flood. The descendants of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The descendants of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. The descendants of Javan were Elishah, Tarshish, Kittim, and Rodanim. Their descendants became the seafaring peoples that spread out to various lands, each identified by its own language, clan, and national identity. The descendants of Ham were Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. The descendants of Cush were Sabah, Havilah, Sabtah, Rama, and Sabtika. The descendants of Rama were Shabar and Dedan. Cush was also the ancestor of Nimrod, who was the first heroic warrior on earth. Since he was the greatest hunter in the world, his name became proverbial. People would say, this man is like Nimrod, the greatest hunter in the world. He built his kingdom in the land of Babylonia with the cities of Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh. From there he expanded his territory to Assyria, building the cities of Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Kala, and Naresin, the great city located between Nineveh and Kala. Mitzrayim was the ancestor of the Luddites, Anamites, Lehabites, Naphtuhites, Pathrusites, Casluhites, and Caphtorites, from whom the Philistines came. Canaan's oldest son was Sidon, the ancestor of the Sidonians. Canaan was also the ancestor of the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, Girgashites, Hivites, Arkites, Sinites, Arvadites, Zemarites, and Hamathites. The Canaanite clans eventually spread out, and the territory of Canaan extended from Sidon in the north to Gerar and Gaza in the south, and east as far as Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim, near Lasha. These were the descendants of Ham, identified by clan, language, territory, and national identity. The descendants of Shem. Sons were also born to Shem, the older brother of Japheth. Now, just note here, if you're reading an NIV, it'll say whose older brother was Japheth. I'll come back to that shortly. Shem was the ancestor of all the descendants of Heber. The descendants of Shem were Elam, Ashur, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. The descendants of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, and Shelah was the father of Eber. Eber had two sons. The first was named Peleg, which means division. But during his lifetime, the people of the world were divided into different language groups. His brother's name was Joktan. Joktan was the ancestor of Almadad, Sheleth, Hazamaveth, Jera, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Ibemiel, Shabar, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were descendants of Joktan. The territory they occupied extended from Mesha all the way to Sephar in the eastern mountains. These were the descendants of Shem, identified by clan, language, territory, and national identity. These are the clans that descended from Noah's sons, arranged by nation according to their lines of descent. All the nations of the earth descended from these clans after the great flood. Now you might jump to one, if you're following your Bibles, jump down to chapter 11 and verse 10. This is the account of Shem's family. 2 years after the great flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. After the birth of Arphaxad, Shem lived another 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arphaxad was 35 years old, he became the father of Shelah. After the birth of Shelah, Arphaxad lived another 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah was 30 years old, he became the father of Eber. And after the birth of Eber, Shelah lived another 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber was 34 years old, he became the father of Peleg. And after the birth of Peleg, Eber lived another 430 years and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg was 30 years old, he became the father of Reu. And after the birth of Reu, Peleg lived another 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu was 32 years old, he became the father of Serug. And after the birth of Serug, Reu lived another 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug was 30 years old, he became the father of Nahor. After the birth of Nahor, Serug lived another 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor was 29 years old, he became the father of Terah. And after the birth of Terah, Nahor lived another 119 years and had other sons and daughters. After Terah was 70 years old, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Hands up if you're still awake. Some of you are still with us. Terrific. Great. You people can stand before any of these people when you get to heaven and say, I read your name, I was there, I was listening. Excellent. Now, the purpose of Genesis 10 and 11 and these genealogies is given to us in the first and last verses of chapter 10. This account of the families of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah. Okay, these are the clans that descended from Noah's sons. And these chapters are actually filling out what was in the previous chapter. So in chapter 9, verses 18 and 19, we read these words. The sons of Noah who came out of the boat with their father were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham is the father of Canaan. From these three sons of Noah came all the people who now populate the earth. So what we're seeing is in chapter 10, we are given a detailed explanation of how the earth was repopulated after the flood. Remember, when they came out of the flood, there was just Noah and his wife and his three sons and their three wives. They were the only people left. It's a record of the descendants of Noah and the various tribes and people groups to which they gave rise and where they settled. And for this reason, Genesis 10 is often called the Table of Nations. Now, not every nation is mentioned in this list, and some of them we can't identify and give their modern equivalent names. Because over the centuries, nations actually can change their names, they move to different locations, they can modify their language, and even their racial composition changes through intermarriage. Nevertheless, we do see some important names cropping up in the genealogies, and we're going to consider some of them shortly. In Genesis 11, the narrative recounts how the nations listed in chapter 10 came about, how they became separate nations after being the unified people who developed subsequent to the time of Noah. We haven't read that part yet, but that's the story of the Tower of Babel. And it seems that the division occasioned by the Tower of Babel that we read about at the start of chapter 11 actually took place during the time of Peleg. Now, Peleg is five generations after Noah. So this is quite a long period of time later. And what we see in chapter 11 is that the second part of chapter 11 traces out the genealogy of Shem through this guy Peleg all the way down to Abram. And why is that important? I'm glad you asked. We'll come to it. But let me make some comments first about the genealogies. Whenever we read about Noah's three sons, they are always given to us in the order Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That was back in chapter 5, verse 32, in chapter 6, verse 10, in chapter 7, verse 13, chapter 9, verse 18, and here in the beginning of chapter 10. They always list them in this order. But if you go back to chapter 9, verse 24, you'll find that Ham is actually the youngest son. This is the story that George told us about last week. Ham, the youngest son, who made fun of his naked father when he got drunk. So Ham is the youngest, and yet he's in the middle of this list. And you might expect that Shem, since he's always listed first, would be the oldest. And in fact, in a number of English translations of Genesis chapter 10 and verse 21, Shem is actually described as Japheth's older brother. So if you've got an ESV or a Holman Bible or a New American or the New English Translation or the New Living Translation, Shem is described as Japheth's older brother. But other English translations say that Japheth was Shem's older brother. The King James does that, the NIV, whichever version of the NIV you've got. So why are these differences occurring? Well, the answer is because in the Hebrew language, it's a little ambiguous. Who is the older of the two, Shem or Japheth? Now, for a number of reasons, and I'm not going to go into great detail about this, but for a number of reasons, including the fact that Shem was 100 years old when he fathered Arphaxad, 2 years after the flood, that tells us that in Genesis 11:10, and Noah was 600 years old when the flood began. We read that in Genesis 7, 6, and 11. It is actually more likely that Japheth is Noah's oldest son. So it's Japheth, then Shem, then Ham. Okay? Shem is the second son. But why then is he always listed first? The Bible often lists children in the order of importance instead of their birth order. And it may even at times omit those who are unimportant to the biblical narrative or chronology. Another example you might be able to think of is Ishmael. Ishmael was actually older than his brother Isaac. Okay? Ishmael was the son of Abraham through his servant, and Isaac was the son through his wife Sarah. But in all the cases where you read about the two, like in 1 Chronicles 1:28, the sons of Abraham are Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac gets named first. And the reason that Shem is listed before his older brother Japheth is because God chose Shem and his line for special blessing. He was to be part of a godly line that led to the nation of Israel through Abram, who became Abraham. Okay, that's why we read these genealogies. That's why the genealogies are here, so that people can see that God is choosing not the firstborn, who everyone might expect to be the firstborn son, the one of promise. It's the second son who actually is chosen. And of course, through Israel, Shem's line ultimately produces Jesus Christ, our Lord and Saviour. In fact, before we even get into the genealogies in Genesis chapter 10, we've already been alerted to the fact that Shem is the key figure, because chapter 9 verse 26 says, "May the Lord, the God of Shem, be blessed, and may Canaan be his servant." So Shem is more important than Japheth. What we then find then in chapter 10 is introducing us to the genealogies of Noah's sons. We have a brief account of Japheth, the firstborn, just a few verses in verses 2 to 5. There's a slightly longer account of Ham's descendants in verses 6 through to 20, primarily because they become major and significant opponents of Israel. Egypt, Canaan, Babylon, the Philistines. These are all people who surround Israel and become a problem for the nation of Israel. And then we have the genealogy of Shem, verses 22 to 31, which at first seems rather ordinary and not overly interesting, until we get the extended genealogy of Shem in chapter 11 from verse 10 to 32. Now, it all goes all the way to verse 32. We're stopping at verse 26 today. And it's there in verse 26 of chapter 11 that we find Abram, who becomes the father of Israel. He is a descendant of Shem. And that's why Shem's line is the one that's given to us. It's important to see how God has sovereignly acted to choose for blessing the second son of Noah, Shem, who would give rise to the man who would faithfully serve him and be a blessing to all the people of the world, which was Abraham. We'll come to that in chapter 12 in due course. And we'll see that God's choice was to bless all the nations of the world through Abraham. Now, of course, the normal practice, as I've already alluded to at that time and throughout history since then, was that all the blessings and privileges go to the firstborn son. Other sons did not have the same value and so didn't count much, and daughters didn't count at all. But that is not the way it is with God. God does not choose the ones that we think should be the favoured ones or the heroes of the story. God often chooses someone else in the family to be a conduit of blessing. And God also gives special places to women. We don't see it in these genealogies, but if you look at the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, you'll find that there are several important women mentioned in the lineage of Jesus and the unfolding story of salvation. God is the God of the unexpected. He always has been, and he always will be. And all of us who are children of God are his children because he has chosen us. None of us is more or less important to God than any other. We're all valued and chosen to receive God's blessings. And that is something for which we can all be very thankful. And we've already been singing about that earlier, haven't we? Thank you for your kindness. Thank you for your goodness. Well, then we come to these descendants of Noah's sons. And they spread throughout the lands east of the Mediterranean. Something like 70 tribes or nations spring from the sons of Noah. The sons of Japheth, so on the left-hand side there, you can see the sons of Japheth, where there are 14 tribes. They spread through the Fertile Crescent. Now, that's a crescent. They're in green on that slide there. A crescent that basically goes from all the way from Egypt through Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria and Iraq, all the way to the Persian Gulf. And they become several nations, some of which will be a threat to Israel in the future. The area of Goma is actually thought to be modern-day Ukraine. So we've been hearing a lot about Ukraine in the news. Goma is thought to be modern Ukraine, Magog, Tubal, and Meshek, which is thought to be modern-day Turkey. So that's the green ones, the sons of Japheth. Then if we go to... It stopped on me. There we go. Then if we go then back to this slide, and we'll see the sons of Ham. There are 30 tribes that come out of Ham's descendants, and they occupy, thank you, Canaan and parts of northern Africa, including Egypt. The Canaanites and the Philistines seem to be descendants of Ham. And inserted into this section, you might recall as we read it, was the story of Nimrod. And he's presented as this mighty hunter, a trait that was commonly found in Assyrian kings. He's more likely, though, to be a tyrant who ruthlessly conquered people and established an empire in the place called Shinar, which is actually where Babylonia is located. And he became the founder of cities like Babylon, Akkad, and Nineveh, and some of those you might recall from reading other parts of the Bible, along with other strong and powerful cities. These also became major enemies of Israel. And then we go back to Shem's descendants, in the middle section there. 26 tribes come from Shem, and their descendants are basically what we call the Semitic peoples, the Arabs and the Jews. And they occupy the area that is now known as modern-day Iran, Iraq, Assyria, and Saudi Arabia. The ancient area of Mesopotamia, where Abraham comes from, the founding father of Israel. And as we saw from chapter 11 and verse 26, he was a descendant of Heber, the son of Shem. And it's through Shem that the line of God's promises passes all the way from Adam down to Abraham and then eventually through to Jesus Christ. And while God has got an ulterior purpose for all the nations, his plan is to work through a chosen people to bring people into his perfect kingdom and to experience his love. They were not chosen because they were more numerous than other peoples, but simply God, because God made an oath to Abraham and chose to love his descendants. And we read about that in Deuteronomy 7:7. This table of nations that I've been talking about is very much a horizontal genealogy rather than a vertical one. That is, its purpose is not to try and trace ancestry and to show every single generation, but to show political and geographical and ethnic affiliations amongst the tribes for various reasons, most notably for holy war. Tribes that are shown to be kin would be in league together. And that table shows the predominant tribes that resided in and around the land that was promised to Israel. And the table also shows that though they were all descended from one man, Noah, and was therefore one people, some were closely related and others were more distant. And of course, they all lived according to their own cultural and linguistic affiliations. And not surprisingly, wars and conflicts are the inevitable result from such differences. And we're seeing that exactly playing out now, aren't we, in Russia and Ukraine. Putin's arguing that Ukraine aren't a people. They don't have a right to exist as a separate people. And of course, the Ukrainians would say, what are you talking about? What rot? You're rewriting history. We've been around a lot longer than what you think and what you have been. Even today, we're seeing lots of countries posturing to increase their empires. China wants to increase its empire and so on. Now, it may seem odd to have this second genealogy for Shem, but as I noted before, Shem is important in God's plan of redemption. And what we see in these verses is a straight line traced out for us from Shem to Abram, who's to become the father of God's chosen people. And through Abram, God would bless the entire world. The dispersal of the nations at Babel in the beginning of chapter 11, which we're just about to look at, seems to close the gates on God's blessing. But God reopens them in a unique way through the commissioning of Abram and later Israel. And as Shem was blessed, the blessing passes down through the lineage to Abram, who is also blessed. This genealogy authenticates God's handing down of the blessing to Abram. The big question, of course, is why we had to jump over the first 9 verses of Genesis chapter 11 to get to this second genealogy. Why does the Tower of Babel incident in those few verses break into these records of the genealogies? It may well be that the story of Babel, the rebellion that we see there and the disposition of the nations, is setting the scene for the role that Abram would play in restoring the dispersed nation, the blessing that was given to Noah and his sons. So let's have a look at the Tower of Babel incident. At one time, all the people of the world spoke the same language and used the same words. As the people migrated to the east, they found a plain in the land of Babylonia and settled there. They began saying to each other, "Let's make bricks and harden them with fire." In this region, bricks were used instead of stone, and tar was used for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let's build a great city for ourselves with a tower that reaches into the sky. This will make us famous and keep us from being scattered all over the world." The Lord came down to look at the city and the tower the people were building. "Look," he said, "the people are united and they all speak the same language. After this, nothing they set out to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse the people with different languages. Then they won't be able to understand each other." In that way, the Lord scattered them all over the world and they stopped building the city. That is why the city was called Babel, because that is where the Lord confused the people with different languages. In this way, he scattered them all over the world. So following the table of nations, the account goes on to explain how the nations came to be scattered across the face of the ancient world. Within 5 generations of Noah, Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, and then Peleg, the Babel event occurs. Genesis 10:25 tells us that Eber, the 4th generation after Noah, had 2 sons. The first one's named Peleg, which means division. And his name is called that because during his lifetime, the people of the world were divided into different language groups. What occurred at the Tower of Babel emphasizes that the flood did not provide a cure for human sin, hubris, and rebellion. God had seen the way that people were behaving and he sent the flood to wipe them out. Didn't solve the problem, because within 5 generations, they're back to doing exactly the same thing. And this whole account is actually a message of judgment. What the people prided themselves in, their unity, actually became their downfall. And what they feared the most, which was being scattered, actually came upon them. It has always been God's intention that people should multiply and fill the earth. Back in chapter 9, verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons and told them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth." But that was meant to happen in obedience to God. And what we see instead is a dispersion resulting from rebellion. In direct contradiction to the command of God, they wanted to stay together, to enhance their unity and strength and to create a reputation for themselves. And they decided that building a stairway to God would achieve these goals. But in God's evaluation, such unity had the potential to result in the greatest evil and this would only lead on to even greater evil. In general, we think of unity as a good thing. And when the thing that unites people of unity leads to worship of God and service in his name, then it is a good thing. Psalm 133, speaking about those who are united in a common passion for Yahweh's name, says how wonderful and pleasant it is when brothers live together in harmony. Verse 3 of Psalm 133 says, harmony is refreshing as the dew from Mount Hermon that falls on the mountains of Zion. And there the Lord has pronounced his blessing, even life everlasting. But friends, God is not always pleased with unity, especially when people unite in rebellion. Here's what Psalm 2 says about such unity. Why are the nations so angry? Why do they waste their time with futile plans? The kings of the earth prepare for battle. The rulers plot together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they cry, and free ourselves from slavery to God. But the one who rules in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. And just like the psalmist is recording, what we see happening in Babel is this unity where people are united against God in rebellion. Brothers and sisters, God loves unity, but he hates it when it results in people being opposed to him. And this raises the question of, to whom have we joined ourselves? If we're united with the world and we follow after the same things as the rest of the world, then we'll end up being opposed to God. Here's what 1 John chapter 1, verses 15 and 16 says. Do not love this world, nor the things it offers you. For when you love the world, you do not have the love of the Father in you. For the world offers only a craving, a physical pleasure, a craving for everything we see, and pride in our achievements and possessions. Sounds a bit like Babel, doesn't it? These are not from the Father, but are from the world. Instead, what Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10 is this. I appeal to you, dear brothers and sisters, by the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ, to live in harmony with each other. Let there be no divisions in the church. Rather, be of one mind, united in thought and purpose. Friends, let us not join ourselves to those who pursue the world's agenda, which is opposed to God, which is infected by the same pride and hubris which infected the people on the plain of Shinar. Let us not be people who pursue our own agenda, who seek our own glory, who try to make ourselves into little gods with our own followers. Rather, let us be of one mind, united in thought and purpose. The Vine Project, which we as a church are undertaking, gives us an opportunity to review our church culture, to make sure that we're all on the same page. And as we progress this over the coming months, I urge you to get on board. Change can be difficult, but we are urged by Paul to be in harmony, to not allow any divisions, and to be of one mind, united in thought and purpose. And may that be our experience. This account of the Tower of Babel tells the story of an ambitious community which tries its strength against God. The people want to build a city which will be the centre of the world and a stairway to the sky. So using the very latest construction materials, bricks and tar, they set about building a tower. It's most likely some kind of ziggurat like you see on the slide there, a multi-story pyramid-like structure which has a ramp or a stairway which leads to the top where a small room was located. And the ziggurats allowed people to climb to the top and to talk with the gods or the gods that was associated with that ziggurat. The ruins of several sacred towers built around 2,000 years before Christ have actually been discovered throughout the area of Mesopotamia. But there's some debate about whether these ziggurats were built to actually enable the people to climb up to the gods, or to allow the gods to come down to the people. Temples were often built on the top and at the bottom, and the idea was that as the god came down, he would have somewhere to stop and refresh himself. In either case, the issue here is that the people were seeking to meet God on equal terms. They had lost sight of who God was. Their view of God had become corrupted. They were already socially and morally destitute, and now they were embarking on a path that would make them theologically destitute. In some respects, brothers and sisters, we're all affected by the Babel syndrome. When we think we can manipulate God by praying in Jesus' name to achieve selfish purposes, then our paganism is showing up. Whenever we think we're indispensable to God and he needs us to do his work, our paganism is showing. When we treat God as a child to be cajoled or a tyrant to be appeased, there is evidence of the Babel syndrome. If we're wanting a palatable form of God, or we try to harness God's power for our own benefit with no strings attached, then we are following in the steps of those at Babel. The legacy of Babel is all around us in Christendom. We see it in the preachers and the televangelists who convince millions that prosperity is a divine blessing and is achieved by claiming the promises of God. We see it in those who see in various diseases, including the current COVID pandemic, as a lack of faith or divine judgment. When we blame God for the suffering in the world or the death of a loved one or a calamity that comes upon us and we turn away from him, we are demonstrating a seriously deficient view of God. This is the legacy of Babel, and it still affects us today. In a sense, the people of Shinar got their wish to encounter God, but not in the way that they expected. God did come down to investigate, and he was hardly afraid of their plans or their in any intended competition, but he was greatly concerned by the emergence of a united, godless society. They crossed a threshold from which there was no turning back. And this is evident from the observation in verse 6. After this, nothing they set out to do will be impossible for them. So to confound the project, God confused the people's language, so that they could no longer work together. They sought to build a united urban environment, but God decided to judge them in a way that would interfere with their current plans, and they were scattered far and wide, leaving the tower half built. It's not clear what the city being built on the plain of Shinar was called. We read it as the Tower of Babel. A number of scholars think it was actually the city of Babylon. It could be. The name Babylon means gate of God, and what the people were building seems to be some kind of gateway to God or to the heavens. And in the story of the Tower of Babel, the name is changed to Babel, which is the right way to say that, which sounds a bit like the Hebrew word for confusion. Balal is the Hebrew word for confusion. So because of God's judgment, the gate of the gods actually becomes the door to confusion. That's what God did in terms of his judgment. And I just want to say, by way of a lesson for us, God's purposes will always be achieved, but not always in the way that is best for people. We can be a part of the solution, or we can be a part of the problem. God's plans, brothers and sisters, will be accomplished. If not with man's obedience, then in spite of his disobedience. Despite the despots like Nimrod trying to build a great nation, it is actually Yahweh, Jehovah, our God, who is the God of geography and history. This is what Acts 17:26 tells us. From one man, God created all the nations throughout the whole earth. He decided beforehand when they should rise and fall, and he determined their boundaries. We see all kinds of things going on in our world, and we sometimes think that, oh, God's gone asleep. He's gone away somewhere. He's not looking to see what's going on. Brothers and sisters, let us never forget that God is the one who's in control of history and geography. He determines when nations rise and fall, and He determines their boundaries. God is in control. What He promises, He performs, and no one nation is superior to another. In God's providence, and perhaps in response to the place that they have given Him in their histories, God has allowed some nations to make greater progress economically and politically than other nations. But their achievements don't prove that they're better than others. And many once great nations have been toppled when they turned away from or against God. Furthermore, God has used pagan nations and rulers to achieve His purposes. He is the one in control, and we must never, ever forget that, especially when we look at what's going on in the world around us right now. Let me wrap up. Some conclusions. This section of Genesis leaves us feeling a little hopeless. The people have been scattered. They can no longer communicate with each other. The unity that they had has been destroyed. The world seems to be in a mess, and a solution is needed. And that will come at the end of chapter 11 and on into chapter 12. And if you stick around for another hour, I'll go through that as well. No way. Out of the scattered nations, God formed one nation, which became His channel of blessing. So God is not done with the human race. These two chapters, 10 and 11, simply prepare us for God's work. And ultimately, Babel will be undone. Zephaniah foreshadows it. He said, "Then I will purify the speech of all people so that everyone can worship the Lord together. My scattered people will come to present their offerings. And on that day you will no longer be ashamed, for you will no longer be rebels against me." And what we see in the book of Acts is a bit of a foretaste at Pentecost, when people were praising, worshipping God together from all the different nations. The important thing about the genealogies in today's passage is that they record the faithfulness of God in watching over His people and fulfilling His promises. What to us is only a list of names was to God a bridge from the appointment of Shem to the recipient of blessing to the call of Abraham, who would be the founder of God's chosen people. God has chosen to use people to accomplish His will. And people are fragile and not always obedient. But brothers and sisters, God remains faithful to His promises. God is still faithful. He still uses imperfect people like you and me. And He wants to use us. We won't always get it right. Sometimes we'll stuff it up big time. Sometimes we'll feel unworthy. Sometimes we will even rebel against God, and there may be consequences for that. But God never gives up on us, because we are His family, His people. If you're feeling discouraged, then remember that God is faithful and He hasn't given up on us. And if we let God be God and have a right perspective of who He is and what He is doing in this world, then perhaps we might just get on board with Him. Perhaps we might finally step out in faith and decide to serve God on the mission field. Perhaps we might step out of our comfort zone and find places to serve in the church where our skills and gifts are needed. Perhaps we might raise the level of our giving, despite the uncomfortable awareness that it might mean giving up some indulgences that we've grown accustomed to. Perhaps it might mean taking a stand for godliness in a difficult situation at work. Perhaps it might mean stepping out of the facade that we've created for ourselves and away from the security that it gives us. These are just a few examples of what a right view of God might mean for us. Of course, God has not left us alone to do these things. Remember, He's faithful. And Psalm 37 verse 5 says this, Commit everything you do to the Lord. Trust him, and he will help you. I trust that these few thoughts on the records and the rebellion in Genesis 10 and 11 will actually help us to remember two key things. One, that our name are part of God's records. Steve was mentioning that a bit in his talk into communion. Our names are part of God's records. They're in God's book of life, those who are his children. And the second thing is this, to realise that rebellion only incurs God's judgment. So let's judge ourselves first before we come under God's judgment. May God bless us as we remember these things, and may we never, ever again skip over reading the genealogy. God bless. Thanks, Phil.